Dr. Omoluwa was educated at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria, where he got his first degree and then his PhD also in history. He was then at the University of London in the Institute of Historical Research for many years. He's been a professor of history of adult education and also head of that department of adult education in the same university, University of Ibadan in Nigeria, for a considerable period from 1982 to 2006. But alongside this went an increasing involvement with UNESCO. He was Nigeria's ambassador and permanent delegate to UNESCO in Paris from 2000 to 2009, and president of the 32nd session of the General Conference of UNESCO for over 2 years. Since then, he's moved more from practical and political experience into research. He's deputy chair of the governing board at the Commonwealth of Learning in Vancouver, in Canada, and a member of the Commonwealth Advisory Council on Teacher Mobility, Recruitment, and Migrations. To move from Dean of the Faculty of Education to UNESCO prominence, and then to much-needed research on teacher mobility, I think shows considerable adaptability and a capacity to keep hold of what's important in terms of understanding the dynamics of education and of educators. So I want to encourage you to look at his publications if you haven't already done so. He's written on adult education practice in Nigeria, literacy programs, development and evaluation process in Africa, the adult literacy census in Nigeria, and he's had essays published in his honor, Widening Access to Education as Social Justice, again taking up this theme of social justice. So we are very honored indeed, to repeat the word, to have Michael Omoluwa with us, and I'd like to invite him to speak now.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Bridget. Like Lala J, you have done much more than I sent in. And it shows the quality of mind of our chair, for whom I have the most profound respect. Thank you very much indeed, and God bless you. My time is 20 minutes. And so what I intend to do is to spend about 10 seconds congratulating the Scotland Committee of the UK National Commission. I hope at an appropriate time I'll be able to show my appreciation, because I've got excellent reports of the quality of work that this Scotland Committee has been doing, and I'm very proud to be associated with this outstanding work of this Scotland Committee of the UK National Commission. I then wanted to show that my idea is to look at interpreting the world through the written word. I hope I will then try and focus on the specific area of health at some stage. But that's what I will be doing for the rest of the time. But like Bridget said, I currently live and work in London, and, associated with the Commonwealth Advisory Council on Teacher Mobility, Recruitment, and Migration. I'm sure that that's a topic that will always be very pertinent to literacy. Basically then, I like to suggest that because of the nature of literacy, there has been a lot of effort to try and define what literacy is. And when you have access to my text, you will then find how I try to show that UNESCO itself being at the vanguard from 1949 in Elsinore, and then moving on in 1960 with the excellent work of Ruby Kidd of Canada, you know, to try at the meeting in 1960 to try and take up the challenges of adult education. And that, of course, gave birth to the work of people like Ruby Kidd, Bud Hall, and you know, those very dedicated people that really assisted us during those years. And then on, as we know, to 1972 in Tokyo, and then 1985 now with Margaret Geifer, again Bud Hall, you know, coming in 1985 in Paris to try and look at what the right to learning is, and that you cannot have the right to learning without really looking at literacy as well. And then from there we get, of course, to 1997 in Hamburg, you know, and the story moves on. Then I tried in my paper to try and identify some of those key elements, the works of John Oxenham when he was at the World Bank trying to defend literacy, since the bank wanted a concrete evidence, you know, that, you know, of the use of literacy. And then of course the series of Habans Bola and Paul Fodam and Alan Rogers, you know, of Kaita, Dan Wagner, of course, you know, I made mention of Lalaji. I did not know that she would actually be at this meeting, because on Tuesday, on the 16th of October, 1971, she sat at an interview panel in which she recommended that I be appointed as an assistant lecturer in adult education. And of course, I've continued to read her work since then. I've tried to talk about Sunday Hezekiah Oluwanwo Temori, Edwin Tansen Coles of Botswana, Conrad Brown, and G.F. Adeyajayi. We have series of them, Roland Oliver, and all, you know, the whole lot. But then I'm trying to say that the work has moved on, you know, since then, and that therefore I will not spend time on this. I'm sure you all know, you know, this background literature. But I wanted to give an idea to suggest that the spoken word is also impressive and very important, and that this was the beauty in the pre-literate African society, where we could not write, but where we had the inculcation of values of integrity, honesty, loyalty, fear of God, and that treachery and betrayers were severely punished, you know, in the system without literacy at the time, and that the women who were illiterate, they were better traders with their encyclopedic knowledge. But that the problem is that the literacy itself, that the word without the written word would not be, you know, complete. And I try to identify, you know, the potentials of writing for development. And you can see with all you've been hearing this morning, you know that will not be relevant for me to take on at the moment. But I just noted that even Jesus Christ himself, you know, was writing on the ground. You remember when the woman was caught in adultery, was brought to his attention, he started writing. What he was writing and all that, we don't know. But the very fact that it was reported that the Son of God was doing the writing, that I thought was very significant. The reading of the word, I said, you know, if you don't read and you don't write, then you cannot continue to influence the future. And I tried to show from the story of the eunuch of Ethiopia who was reading, you know, remember from his travel he was reading. And of course the film, Educating Rita, you remember, I'm sure many of you remember what Educating Rita was trying to teach, you know, in terms of, you know, reading to be able to, you know, to discover yourself. And therefore I then concluded with the comment by Orson that speech makes us human and literacy makes us civilized. So we can be human without being civilized. But if we are literate, you can both be human as well as civilized. I then try to give some of the reasons for all that, but you know, I will not have time to develop all that. I hope that you will see that from my writing. Now, I decided to give some examples from Africa, and I tried to quote Brian in my paper. You know, and you know, he said For the Africa, maybe I should just say it. This Simon Barnes, he's a writer for The Times, and he wrote in his contribution, he says, Africa is great. Africa is full of great people doing great things. Africa is a place of joy, of inspiration, and of hope. To spend time in Africa is to change your understanding of the world, and to do so for the better. Every visitor to Africa, no matter how generous, gains more from Africa than he is capable of giving. Africa is not a basket case. Africa is not a place without hope, without hesitation, without ambition, without plan. Africa is not remarkable only for its wounds, whether self-inflicted or inflicted from outside. Africa remains Africa. It is greater than we can understand and infinitely richer. And, you know, I then decided to give some of my examples from Africa, what one of them said, you know, that I open my heart in the letters and I write what nobody would know except my friends. When I receive confidential letters, nobody knows my secret except the persons in whom I confide. And this witness was trying to compare the situation before literacy and now, you know, that she became literate. Because in the past, she would then dictate what she wanted and somebody else would write. And that was like giving herself up. And that's the type of things that there's no money that can buy. I also gave the example of the one saying that I can now sign my check in my checkbook so that at least nobody even knows the balance, you know, of your checkbook once you can sign and read, you know, have your account yourself. I then will now be leading on now to say I can vote. And that's very, very important. And then I try to say that that's okay for literacy. But I think Lalaji and all the others today have been emphasizing this important point about the future of literacy. What will you do without being able to read, I mean, to use to send a text message or to receive a text message? And then I then try to focus attention on some of those marginalized. I think it's one in 28, the one that Ralph was talking on earlier today. I was talking of the refugees. I was talking of the immigrant population. I was talking of the underprivileged, the voiceless, those people that we must actually focus attention on so that when they are trying to get on in this difficult, complex society, you know, and trying to study the society, you know, the asylum seekers, the poor and the disadvantaged, then we don't discover that it is mandatory, it is part of social justice that we should be able to focus on them. And then I said that related to literacy, related to health, that literacy can be applied, you know, for the health issue, that you can begin now to look at the classes, you know, you organize literacy classes, you know, to as bedrock for social activities, because the isolated people we find out we've been told that the cause of depression is really not relating to other people, and that literacy classes can actually be a form of solution to that problem of depression, loneliness, and isolation. And that I try to give the example of that university that says that the social isolation can be equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day, and that therefore, even for health itself, fighting obesity and all that, that literacy, you know, activity, it can be a prescription. But that we can even go beyond that and begin to see the example of the awareness of issues like drinking safe water and sanitation and hygiene. We also have the example. I try to give the example from our own health project at home, that everybody believes now that if you attend literacy, then even for your own health, you have the hope, you have the encouragement, you can also pursue a healthy life, and then you share the experiences of others, and then you can also read, you know, you can read the prescription, and then you can also find out some of the problems that are causing the ailments. You can even Google, you know, you can and then you find that you are happy, you keep on living a happy life. And now that I have just 3 more minutes, I then said that I will spend that 3 minutes by saying that I hope you all have access to my paper, and I then wanted to say Africa has always had very, very close relationship with Scotland, and that two of the major outposts for the training of the earliest Nigerian educated elite were King's College London and the Universities of Scotland, and that the first set of Nigerian medical students, William Broughton Davies and James Africaners Bill Houghton, were trained in Scotland, and they became the first medically qualified Africans in 1858 and 1859, and that therefore it should be it is important for Africans to be able to appreciate the investment in the education of Africa when it was getting to its feet. But I then said that it is that my enthusiasm to accept the invitation to share my thoughts today was also informed by the noble role that Scotland had historically played in the development of Africa, and that indeed the history of Africa cannot be complete without mention the role that the people of Scotland played in assisting the region. And I tried to bring in the work of David Livingstone. And I said this David Livingstone came to Africa, especially South Africa, Botswana, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Malawi. And he brought the message about Jesus Christ, and he introduced reading, focusing attention at that time on the Bible. And of course, the people looked at his name, which they called Livingstone, which, you know, by the way, is the stone that lives, and that since the stone lives forever, and that is symbolic of Jesus Christ, whom he tried to introduce to that part of Southern Africa, that Jesus Christ, even though he's dead, he's alive again and is living forever. He is the living stone. And then from there, I tried to introduce Mungo Park, you know, the Mungo Park, the Scottish explorer, who led the historic expedition to the coast of River Niger, and therefore was able to bring development across that River Niger, after which Nigeria actually took its name in 1897. And that after Mungo Park, we also had the work of the Presbyterian Mission that established the activities, especially in eastern Nigeria, and brought industrial education through the Hope Waddell Institute. And that many of the products of that Hope Waddell Institute contributed to the independence movement of Nigeria. I cited the work of Mary Slessor, the young lady who was helpful in ensuring that twins were no longer killed. Those are the ones that I've said. I have just 1 more minute. And I said, young and old, male and female, they came to Africa, they lived and served there, and they died there, leaving the legacy of the written word. And that this UK, this 2010 Glasgow lecture is for me a completion of my work, starting with the University of London, where I was a Commonwealth Fellow about 35 years ago, and from University of London, coming to the University of Glasgow, and therefore concluding, you know, that pilgrimage that was done by my ancestors, and for which I therefore thank you, and God bless you.